So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. Hello, everyone. My name is Cindy Blackstock, and I'm really honored to join you from unceded and unsurrendered Algonquin territory here in Ottawa for another edition of Spirit Bear's podcast. And this time, we have an amazing guest, Gary Mavis. And Gary is a social worker. He's been working now, we're calculating before we started, 50 years as a social worker, giving up his experience and his skills to particularly young people in mainstream, but also in Indigenous settings. He and I have known each other, we were thinking, for 35 years, and he has really got a unique combination of training, skills, and most important, this guy just falls in love with kids. And that kind of love and compassion has really guided him in his work in understanding trauma, and also understanding the inequities that really underpin the disadvantage for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit young people. He's a former executive director of the Federation of Aboriginal Foster Parents, which was a great organization that brought together all the carers who were looking after Indigenous children, whether the carer was Indigenous or not, and really supported them in learning more about the cultures, about how to care properly for Indigenous children and young people. And since his retirement, he's been a key member of Teddy's Homes, and he'll tell us more about that. But Teddy's Homes is an innovative and successful residential program in the Fraser Valley near Vancouver that has a real strong cultural base to the programs. And they practice a lot of trauma-based practice with children and young people who have had developmental issues. So without further ado, I want to introduce and welcome Gary Mavis, my longtime mentor and friend, and I've just admired so much of what you've done over the years. So welcome, Gary.
Thank you, Cindy, and you've been my mentor for all these years, and I've always tried to remember to follow your witness programs, and I've told the story as told by you and your organization and the work that you do, so I continually repeat the story and what is important to be told that must be told. So thanks very much for inviting me today, and glad to be part of this.
Well, that's awesome. And for everybody else, if you want to follow Gary's example, go on to the I Am a Witness campaign. Tells all the documents about the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, and also jordansprinciple.ca, where we have all the information about the inspiring story of Jordan River Anderson and his legacy of Jordan's principle. So that's exactly what we hope would happen, is that people become carriers of the message and educate people in their different circles. So, Gary, you were the executive director of the Aboriginal Foster Parents Association. Some people knew it by the acronym FAFP that was in British Columbia. Can you tell us a little bit about what that organization did and why it was so important for children and young people?
It was interesting. After being with the MCFD for many years, when they cut back, I retired and let the younger people that were possibly going to be removed from their positions. So I said, I'll make way for that and moved to work with VACFAS for a program, and then came in contact with FAFP that was just starting, getting going, and specifically for the caregivers of Indigenous youth and children that were in care, regardless of where they were in the province. It was a provincial agency run from the Greater Vancouver area. And their job was to be an advocate for the caregivers of these kids in care. And what was difficult, of course, is that there were not enough First Nations caregivers. And that's one of the big problems that has, of course, been identified years ago, but not really worked on in terms of preparing the non-Indigenous caregivers. So what we did is we worked with the other provincial agency, the Federation of Foster Parents, and provided training. Once we got going, when I was there, we provided a lot of First Nations training, experiences, ceremonies, travels, really as much as we could with a very small group of people. There was only, I think we had 5 total staff for the province, which was not sufficient, as we know in child welfare systems. We had an office in Kelowna and also on the island. But there was so many cases of First Nations kids in care that it was a struggle to do that. But what we wanted to do is educate. And as I said, most of the caregivers were not Indigenous caregivers, which is still a problem today. It's just something that a lot of the non-Indigenous caregivers just had no education, knowledge, as the general population does, of the total system of colonialism in BC and in Canada. So that was part of our work as well, to educate them in that. But we provided training, again, in context with the other federation of foster parents, monthly. We provided cultural programs in our building, whether it's dancing, language. We even provided a small powwow that we put on ourselves. We got Chief Willard Cook to come and do some work with us. We also worked with VACFAS, which was the Vancouver Aboriginal Child and Family Services. We worked with them doing programs to educate the caregivers and introduce the kids, because a lot of the kids in care did not have a cultural connection, which is really ongoing difficulty to this very day. They just didn't have that connection and had to relearn so much.
Yeah, and I was actually really honored to actually attend one of those training seminars with the families. And it was so enlightening because there was the cultural base and all that history you're talking about. But then there was also like, how do we deal with the trauma that young people have gone through as a caregiver? How do I support this young person in building different types of relationships, making those connections with community that may not have existed before? All of those were kind of big things that you were having conversations with carers with. When you look back at that time, what do you think were some of the most important pieces that caregivers ought to know in order to respectfully and honorably care for a First Nations, Métis, or Inuit child?
Well, they at least must have some basic understanding, besides their moral background and care for humans in general, but they must have some kind of a understanding of the trauma that has been for hundreds of years resulting in the kids that end up in care, and how to get them to understand and really, besides being caring, loving, kind, providing food and shelter and everything else, that's just the base. They needed to understand the trauma, not only of what has happened to these youth in previous times, but the fact of the trauma of coming into care, the very basic trauma of coming into care, regardless of what the situation was, abuse or neglect or whatever it was, didn't matter. That trauma is compounded whenever a kid comes into care. For instance, the Inner City Foster Parents Project that I worked on pre-coming to FAFP, we had groups of the local caregivers of First Nations kids, and we provided courses, we did training, we did outings, we did Christmas dinners, we did summer projects, we did tour of lights with the kids and their caregivers, trying to get them to understand more of what really is needed. We took the youth to Sundance ceremonies up at Coldwater for numbers of years in a row when there. It may not be their cultural background. It might be not their nations, but at least it indicated how connected the band and the workers and dancers and masters and elders that were there, the impact that had on me even more so. But the kids got to see that different from the greater Vancouver area. So we tried to do that, whether it was at our AGMs or whether it was through the programs that other agencies brought in. We would connect whatever we could to get the caregivers' understanding of what really the case is. It's not just kid is in trouble and we're going to bring him into a foster home. It's way beyond that.
And I think that's hard for people to understand. Like, we often hear with traumatic experiences, the post-traumatic stress disorder and PTSD. A lot of people in the general public can relate to that. They can think about people who are in car accidents that may have had it, or people who had a violent experience or a traumatic loss. Those are things that are all relatable. But what's difficult, I think, for a lot of people to understand for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities as a result of colonialism, including residential schools, is you almost get a collective PTSD that's it lasts across generations. And then you have this young person at the end of it who is inheriting some of that, but also their parents and families aren't given the same kind of opportunities to address that trauma that's been passed down to them and get on a healthy path as parents. Is that fair to say?
Yes, oh, definitely. And of course, now looking back, I realize that there weren't the resources, and many, many, many people in the field said if we could just put more resources in the families pre-coming into care, we would be farther ahead. However, as we know, the Ministry for Children and Families, whatever it was called in those days, it came down the list. And when the Treasury Board went to the Victoria to ask for dollars, it came down the list because children and families do not produce dollars. They consume dollars. And that's another one of my semi-rants, where we know that the need for outreach and community workers is lacking. So we tried to do the best, and I used to battle with the ministry and the delegated agencies as well to provide better care for the caregivers so that they could do a better job for the kids that were in care. And that was hard. And now, of course, looking forward to where I am today, I see that the success of things like culturally inclusive caregiving is the benefit of that.
Yeah, that's right. And even today, I think, you know, I agree with you. I don't think that we're providing the level of support, whether it's a kinship care provider or someone else. When you're trying to support a child or a young person through the experience of having to be separated from their family because the family is not in a place of wellness, we need to do a far better job of supporting them. And with that, is the FAFP still around, Gary, or is that no longer an organization?
I don't think it's functioning. It's been 10 years since I retired for the second time there. And they had difficulties, and I don't believe that they're functioning to the same degree at all that they used to.
Yeah, which is really too bad. And here's something that, like, for people to know, that I think a couple of things you made said are really important. One is, these problems about the need to support families before they come into contact with child welfare, we've been saying that for decades. And it has been short-sighted governments that think that these children and families are a cause. But by not doing it, the families and children go into more crisis, and it actually costs government more. And more importantly, people lose their childhoods and loss. So that's important for people to know. This wasn't just a recent thing that we realized, these preventatives. We've known for decades. And people like Gary were sounding the alarm way back then. The second is, we all need to do a far better job of supporting these carers. And I want to go even beyond the people who have got the child or the young person physically in their home, to the circle of care around those children, to provide people with the information so that they can provide kind of trauma-informed care. So Gary, like we hear this, like trauma-informed and culturally relevant care gets thrown around a lot, but what does it actually look like from your perspective?
There's a couple of things. One is the way that now I'm working and supporting Teddy's homes is as I think as impacting and appropriate as anything that I have come in contact with. But the very fact of having inclusive, culturally inclusive caregiving includes understanding and how to work with the trauma that is there. And what we in the past used to do, it was helpful, but we would deal with a specific case. So it would be FASD. If we have a kid that's got FASD, we deal with this way. This is how we do it because we know that that child or youth cannot deal with math or is very impulsive. So that's something that we try to provide at Teddy's Homes in a total capacity. So we have Chuck Getty's team to provide training. Some of it is one-to-one work with the youth. Some of them that have come from the Maples organization in Vancouver, our caregivers went to there and were trained in the Maples how to deal with a youth that was really extreme situations. Well, that youth came into Teddy's Homes finally after the caregivers were trained and how to work with that. And that youth, who would be scary to read his initial reference documents, is back home. Still part of Teddy's Homes, because anybody that ever comes into Teddy's Homes is always part of Teddy's Homes. They leave, they're blanketed when they leave, and they're always part, depending on nothing. Doesn't matter where they are, how difficult the situation is, or how good it is, they're always part. So that whole thing has to be a parcel. It has to be inclusive. The culture, the trauma, the care, the fun and games that we do have. You know, I can go on and on. We have a 42-foot journey canoe that we just purchased. And we're going on the journey from Mission to Lummi Island in the States in the end of July and August. We will be pulling on the journey canoe in stages, as you know, how we go down this. So that's where I'm going to be on it. So that's going to be a first for me. So
are you going to be the captain of the canoe?
Oh, no. I will be the 14th first mate. The canoe, 16 pullers, 20 people in the one canoe. So it's a big experience for me, something new for me. But we have our training, and the youth are come out and try. Some of them, of course, they don't want to come. And that's another problem that we talk about always, is that a lot of the youth are not connected to their culture. In some cases, as you encounter, they don't know their culture. They don't know their nation. So we work with that.
Yeah, it's so important. Like the number of things you're hitting on here is that you have to look at it in such a holistic way, and you can't just, quote, fix the child. Like it has to be kind of everyone is involved in this, and everyone's wellness is part of, that encircles the child, has got to be a priority. And then also just like with the kids who have been disconnected from their culture, is trying to just slowly provide positive experiences that encourage them to go down the path of reconnection. But sometimes I find that like if you just push it too fast, then they just, like teenagers will, they'll just push back at you. And so, you know, it's a delicate thing about, you know, providing them with as many positive experiences as possible and good opportunities to reconnect to family and to community as you possibly can.
You have to have an understanding that we're not going to fix all these situations. We're not going to be able to have perfect results for every kid. So every one of Teddy's Home staff, and I'm talking about the accountant, knows every caregiver, every kid by name and sight. So when we go to our team meetings, no kids and youth involved there, we'll have 30 people and everybody goes, unless the ones that have dealing with the youth that they have to be with, because they're not in school, or they're not in daycare, or they're not in whatever, they have an appointment or whatever. But our team meetings have everybody. So the accountant, who you would not think would be involved, is totally involved and knows all the kids, knows all the caregivers, and knows everybody. So everybody's in a circle. It's always the circle.
You know, and you're talking about the accountants coming, and I think back to that conversation we had just a few minutes ago about the government not investing in families before they get into crisis. If more of those accountants and Treasury Board actually knew these families and can see the value and the humanity of these children and young people, then maybe better decisions would be made. So I'm just so delighted to hear this, and also for the kids to know that, you know, it's like walking into a place where everyone knows you and that you matter. You matter enough that I know your name and I know who your family is and all the rest of that. Like that's so important, right, to people.
We go to the graduations when they go to school and they graduate, whether it's grade 12 or accompanying grade 12, they have different levels. But that's something that we take really a pride in. And as I said before, they're blanketed when they leave. And we always tell them, you're always part of Teddy's Homes. It's not you're 19, you're gone. It's none of that.
Or you're going home and you're gone. And I think this is another area where we've not done good at all. And when we're returning children, often what a lot of our listeners may not know is a lot of the supports that come from a child being in care, historically, those supports would be gone after the child goes back to the family. And in fact, that's a really important time for the family to get extra support and for that young person to have continuity of support going through there. So the fact that at Teddy's Homes, you're saying, look, you know, we're doing this blanket ceremony, but we're still here. We're still part of your community and we're here to support you. That is a best practice for everybody to be thinking about.
And a little anecdote, one of the boys that was a real handful, well, he was blanketed and went to live with a relative. And during our travels, staff, two of them dropped in to the new home. Well, not new home, but the home where he returned to, or family, and was so happy to see them. And he said, when I get upset, I just go get my blanket, the blanket that he was blanketed in when he left. So that's a good case. There's been sad cases. We've lost kids that had difficulties after 19 and had them from the day one and passed. Unfortunately, we've had cases like that. So it's not easy, but we have the celebration and we're totally involved in all of that. We knew the family, regardless of their difficulties as well. So it's tough, it's sad, but you do what you can do. And everybody at Teddy's Homes tries in that whole inclusive way, always in their mind, that's just what happens. However, we receive good dollars for those high-risk kids, and that's helpful in the fact that we're able to provide good resources. So that, again, goes back to the problems from decades. The foster parents are quite often not able to do extra things, and they're not as connected as a group like Teddy's Homes. We will probably not have more than 10 homes, probably not.
And how many children in each home, Gary, relatively?
We have 1, 2, 3 homes with two, and then 5 singles. So we would have maybe a single house parent, or we have a couple of house parents full-time. The house parents get relief every month, So we have support and relief workers working in the system as well. So they get really good relief, which foster parent would never get because it's costly. So again, it gets back to the resources.
Yeah. And what we're asking for is like monies for families so that you can deal with the trauma while the child's at home and it doesn't get worse. And then for those kids who do need to go into care, you want to try and keep them in the most family-like environment, which is typically the foster homes. But then if there's some young people who are their trauma needs are just too much and they need to be in places that provide more intensive care, like Teddy's homes. And all three of those things should be possible at the same time.
Yes. And again, the kids that are not able to be on their own when they get to be 19, quite often go into CLBC, which is a group with somebody in the home that would not be their caregiver, but be a support for them. So they would be on their own, in their own unit, and maybe have dinner with the person that's maybe upstairs who runs their own home, or just provide sort of supervision to make sure that they're going to their job or their workshop, or they're doing okay. So it's not being a caregiver in the sense of you're looking after everything, but CLBC provides dollars for them to live in a home and go into maybe work or, as I say, workshops or whatever that may be, because they can't be on their own, totally on their own.
Yeah, this transition out of care, you've got a bit of a plan for those kids. Now we got post-majority for federally funded First Nations kids.
Yes.
But it's still not a smooth journey for many children. And so even for those young people who have done the courageous and important work, kind of starting to process their trauma, there can be a major setback when at 19, all of these supports fall away only because you had a birthday. I mean, that just drives me nuts. That's your birthday present, losing all the supports. Like, why are we doing that to children and young people? Like, it just makes no sense, right?
I remember years ago, the Pat from New York that provide Never Alone or something like this in New York, where they provided care. You're never going to be left alone. Doesn't matter what happens, we're going to look after you.
You know, being a parent is hard, but growing up is harder. And people forget that. One of the most challenging parts of life is between ages of 12 and probably 20. What a struggle it is, even in the best of circumstances. But when you come from a family situation and where there's been multi-generational trauma, it just makes it that much more difficult on an uphill climb for these young people, right? So we really got to do better right from even before the baby's born.
Yes, yes. And that's, again, I worked main in Hastings down in Vancouver. We had a resources support system that we could add into families. We had a budget of so much per our office on Hastings. And every year we would get the word from the headquarters that we were overspending our resources because we put in homemakers and things like that into the homes trying to help. And every year we overspent and we just kept on doing it, which got higher ups in trouble because the budget wasn't there. But those types of things are what is needed, because it may need just a bit of a help to get things straightened out so that the kids don't become neglected. Because most of the kids that come into care are not abuse. It's neglect.
Yeah,
it's basic neglect, maybe with some abuse in some ways. It's, again, the resources and, again, the difficulty to get that.
Gary, we're going to be wrapping up here in a minute. If people wanted to find out more information about Teddy's Homes, where could they go? Do you guys have a website or anything like that where people could go and learn more?
Yes, teddyshomes.com. So there's a video that FAFP did, which I hope you've seen. Together We Have Raised the Children.
Yeah.
And Teddy's, that's why we call it Teddy's Homes. Teddy was a mother of three of the kids that Deb Hartland, who started Teddy's Homes, she worked with Auchmuth Delegated Aboriginal Agency. And she had three kids, Robert, who was seven, and two younger ones. So if you've seen that video, the two younger ones are not identified, but Robert was over 19. So when they did the interview with Teddy, Deb, and Robert, they told the story. So when he was 20, he could speak about being in Deb's home from seven, when he was seven. He said, I've been in seven homes since when I got to Deb's.
Wow.
He was only seven. He'd been in seven homes. And he could speak now about how Deb worked. And Deb included Teddy, the mom, over. She was not able to care for kids. Yeah. She could not do it. She had real difficulties. But Deb brought her in over a period of months and months and years. First, maybe Christmas time. Then it was Easter. And then it was summer. And Deb did this on her own, not through the social workers encouraging this. Deb did it on her own. So finally, the kids got to see their mom and loved their mom and vice versa.
Well, we ought to track down that film or see if we can do it and post a link when we share this with our viewers. And, you know, like, I just think that we're in this space now where we're starting to see these services get into families as people like you have advocated for decades. But we're also at the same time going to be dealing with young people who are really experiencing all that trauma and will need that specialized wraparound care that includes the parents, like you're talking about. When I was working at the Squamish Nation, I just want to say what an honor that was to work at the IS Mun Mun program there. But there was part of what they were doing is recognizing that for some parents, there were limitations about what they could do for children, sometimes as a result of FASD or their own trauma or whatever their family circumstances. But there were also things they could give those children that no one else could. It was about setting up a different concept of parenting that was more collective, where I'm going to do these pieces because I can do this as as friend of mom and friend of the child, and then mom can give the child these special things. It doesn't have to be like your 24/7 parent or you're out of the picture. And that kind of work that, you know, in this story is just with Teddy is just beautiful, right? Because at least for those children, having suffered the loss of their mother, they had a relationship with her and she got to be with her kids during special times in their lives and share the love that only she could give them.
It's important that they know that even when they've left a resource, that there's that connection. And I always felt it was difficult. And this is a knock on provincial child welfare. If a family is really doing a good job with a kid in care, when they go back home, the consistency is sometimes cut off. So even if the caregivers are not First Nations, they could be aunt and uncle.
Yeah, that's
grandma
right.
And grandpa. Doesn't matter what culture you're in. If you had a good relationship, that's a good thing to keep. So you notice it because when we hire somebody in Teddy's homes, I'm on the HR department, you say, well, actually, I was a caregiver 10 years ago, and I've just been invited to the former kid that was in care to the wedding or the birth or the birthday or something. Or I see them in town and they all come running over and say hello. That's the type of system that we want.
Yeah, you want adults to kind of organize themselves so that they're not kids that don't have to make a choice between who loves them.
Yes.
But whoever can offer that loving support has got to be part of the circle. And there's all kinds of ways to do this in a healthy way. So, and you kind of showed us the roadmap. Gary, some parting words of wisdom from you to the collective about how to responsibly and lovingly care for young people with trauma.
That we continue to work with the most important resource in the world, which is our youth, and that we provide connections to their family or to people that can be substitute families for their betterment through their youth, through their education, and for when they're older even, and want the governments in power to support that and understand that that is, in the long run, the most effective and efficient way to care for the kids that have been traumatized through life and through situations.
Well, thank you, Gary, for your years of dedication to kids and families and for sharing with us all of your experience on working with young youth who have experienced traumatic experiences. I've learned some new stuff. I'm going to look up some of these resources that you mentioned. And yeah, I just want to say a warm thank you for joining us on Spirit Bears Podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and all the best in your work. And I follow the work of First Nations Child and Family Caring Society since, I guess, the beginning, which is a long time. And all the best in the work that you do and your agency there.
Thank you.
All the best.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bears Ask an Expert Podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes.